Hello again and welcome to another episode of Voices from SA. My name is Nicholas Claude. Thanks for joining me wherever you are. I hope all is well. Shout out to all the Springbok fans out there. My guest this week is Lebohang Peko. She's a feminist, an activist, a scholar, researcher and public intellectual. She runs the Four Rivers Consultancy and is a research fellow at the progressive think tank Trade Collective. Her areas of interest include regional, continental political economy, globalization, and the movement of people, much of this with a feminist bent, feminist perspective. We had a wide-ranging discussion that kicked off with a look at some thoughts from her on the midterm budget from the Minister of Finance, Tito Mboweni, recently. And that took us into a really quite wide-ranging discussion on the state of the economy in general, on the historical legacy that faces the ANC in trying to restructure particularly sections of the economy or sectors of the economy, such as mining or agriculture in particular. She also spoke about the importance of access to proper, meaningful education and efficient healthcare for all South Africans, and just how important these are as basic rights. Lebohang also gave some perspective on the forces in our society that force African women to the periphery of our economy and our society in general. We then also touched on South Africa's relationship to the continent and her dream of a Pan-African future for us all. So please now enjoy my chat with Lebohang. Lebohang, thanks so much for your time. Again, like with many of the guests I have on the podcast, people are running around, very busy, and I appreciate you taking the time to speak to me today.
It's really a pleasure.
And I'm looking forward to a fascinating discussion. Maybe before we start, you could just sort of tell us a little bit about yourself. You are a fellow at an organization called the Trade Collective. Mm-hmm. You have your own company, is that called Four Rivers?
Correct.
Can you just tell me a little bit about those two components, aspects of your life?
Yeah, so Four Rivers is a management consulting, doing development work, development consulting to governments or NGOs, funders, corporates occasionally, particularly in the areas of economic policy analysis, mm-hmm. And also trying to look at what market rates and market trends are looking like across the continent. And then also, I think quite importantly, doing quite hardcore contextual research into key sectors, industrial sectors.
Right.
That's been running for about 15 years.
Oh, wow, so okay.
It's all grown up. Yeah, all grown up. That's a lot of fun. And then
so that takes you around the continent then, sub-Saharan Africa?
Slightly, yes, slightly. And then the other piece of that, which is I think the piece that I also enjoy, is sort of scholar activism, as I call it. I think of myself as a scholar activist, which is an activist scholar, and the Trade Collective is a small think tank. We like to think of ourselves as progressive, and we deal in a few key areas, and the one is international trade, especially South African and Africa's position within that.
Mm-hmm.
The second aspect would probably be the political economy, and the political economy of regional integration across the region.
Right.
And then the third piece of that is to do with globalization and what migration policy looks like and movement of people looks like in the context of a globalized world. And there's always this like strange interface and sometimes quite as combative relationship between the capacity of people as individuals to move between states and the capacities and privileges that corporates receive in the same realm. So the three are quite interconnected, and that's the sort of thing that enables me to do a lot of academic work and also to do quite a lot of global activist movement building, local, regional, and global activist movement building, which is pretty much my heartbeat.
Well, I'd love to certainly, I'm intrigued and have been intrigued on South Africa's sort of political and economic relationship to sub-Saharan Africa, in particular SADC, the southern region, and let's hopefully touch on that a little bit later in the discussion. Then, of course, immigration, movement of people is also quite a fascinating topic, because you see there again also those disconnects. You know, business people can move as expats, but desperate people move as refugees, and that whole sort of disconnect or dichotomy is quite interesting. I want to start, if I may, just by touching a little bit on, we had the midterm budget report, I think it's called, from the finance minister Mboweni last week. It came in the shadow or against the background of his, I don't know if it was a controversial document in its context, the discussion document he released, I think, 2 or 3 months ago now, which had quite a sort of long and complicated name, which I won't get into now, but it was some, you know, around economic inclusive growth, economic transformation, those sort of kind of sexy buzzwords. What was the purpose of that first discussion document in the context of the budget? The way I sort of read it, the document was, the initial document was a strategy document, but there was a lot of discussion about how it was actually released and under whose auspices and whose authority it was released, maybe not so much as to what it was saying, but sort of quite, I suppose, thought through, if that was how you want to sort of put a plan or strategy together. But it comes on the back of many other plans or strategies. And also in the context then of a budget that basically said, well, there is no more money, and we don't really, you know, the cupboard is bare, essentially. And he was kind of just pleading for government official to spend less money, and that was going to be a way forward. How do you see our sort of current economic circumstances, and then the strategies or policies are then put on top of that to try and mitigate or transform our economy?
I would say ambivalent and somewhat stale. So the document that the minister released at the end of August, I think it was.
Yes,
now,
that's right. No.
Then he gave the members of the public about 4 weeks or something to respond, I think, until September the
24th. There was some sort of attempt to engage.
At a public participatory engagement, which was really trying to, it was very industrialist, firstly. So it was speaking to industrial interests and trying to encourage corporates and corporations to be a bit more proactive in their role in economic development and in galvanizing, recatalyzing economic development in this country. The second piece was a bit on small to medium enterprises. And there he really then says that not as much that there will be a bit more support for them, but he makes the role of SMMEs a bit more preeminent and reminds us that these are very much part of the engine of the economy. Thirdly, he speaks somewhat about the state-owned enterprises, which is a bit of a hotbed right now. It's a bit of a hot potato, given the huge drain that they've been on the state fiscus. And he speaks to greater efficiencies, the need for greater efficiencies. And I suppose in that document, he was alluding to once more the great possibility and probability right now of them being chopped up into three little pieces and privatized, essentially. Fourthly, he then alludes to...
That's Eskom in particular.
Eskom specifically, actually. And that's an important point, because we now speak as though the other SOEs no longer exist, or they have corrected themselves.
Or they're not as in dramatic a state.
They're probably not in as dramatic disarray explicitly, although I think behind the scenes there's probably room to, there's probably room to re-rationalize and rethink all of them. A lot of them, you know, come back from almost 100 years old, right? I mean, you know, you have your Danelles and you have what, Eskoms, you have your
the Airways.
Yeah, the Airways, your SABC. SABC is quite new because actually we didn't have television in this country until the other day, actually, the late the 80s. But others were really to do with an apartheid machinery, which was trying to build an industrial capacity in that was inward looking, remember, because of the sanctions.
And very specific as well to a group of people.
Very specific for a key group of people. I mean, it was obviously about white, primarily Afrikaner interests, to some extent English speakers as well. And I think it was also about trying to ensure that it was very siege. It was, they were built and developed in the atmosphere of a siege mentality. So remember that it comes off the back of an inherent sense of Afrikaner martyrdom, right, which came out of the Second World War, prisoner of war camps, and the sense that never again should this should they feel as though they were beholden to everybody else, right? And then hence the need to build a defense, quite a formidable defense machinery, and needing then, of course, the telecommunications to do so, the electricity and the energy surplus to do so. This also then was part of how the... you know, the four regions, you know, of the four parts of the union, what was then the union in inverted commas of South Africa, developed even more quickly, because then when you had the telecommunications machinery, things were then just a phone call away. Things were a telegram away, and that in those days was as close to an SMS or email.
It was as fast as you could get.
So this was after, you know, years of, say, people, you know, riding across the country on horseback for a few weeks to get a message. So that was
sailing ships and
so on and so forth. So I think we shouldn't underestimate the extent to which there was a lot of intentionality, but that was quite cutting edge. Now, a few things have happened. The one is that many of the reasons for, you know, the existence of those SOEs has shifted significantly. For one thing, we're not in a siege mentality. So, you know, the huge amount of money that was spent on developing a weapons machinery and a weapons complex in this country.
A military-industrial complex.
Yeah, well, really don't exist.
A security kind of state.
It was a very securitized state. I mean, of course, it was a very securitized, nervous state, and one that felt as though they had enemies everywhere, which they probably did, in fact.
Sounds like elements of the ANC today.
Which is quite ironic, yes. And so, I mean, the history of SOEs is really carved in all that. It's also carved in a huge job creation machinery. You know, this was a place to absorb. You know, young Yaku didn't look like he knew what he was doing with his life.
But we'll get him a job on the railways.
That was exactly the place. Yeah, that was exactly the. So we have this sort of machinery that wasn't dismantled and wasn't rationalized post 1994. And my thoughts around Eskom in particular have been that we can decentralize the power supply mechanism, whether it's across provinces, and rather than trying to chop it off into the little pieces. Or the other option to that would be possibly to quasi, I don't want to call it privatizing, but you can kind of re-rationalize it in a way that it's up for public, you know, for shareholder interests, right? Which is what some couple of European countries have done. But it would be, you would maintain a majority state stake, which is quite important as a symbol, but I think also because I don't think that we want to go down the route of entirely privatizing utilities. What that might do is that it might open up a bit more resources to do the things that need to be done. It would, however, significantly shift the culture from one which is very statist to one which means that they will have to be a more of a shareholder approach, which I am personally even ambivalent about. and I think that many people would be very ambivalent about that. However, right now I'm thinking that...
You're saying not necessarily a bad thing in this context then, some kind of stakeholder, even though it might go against your sort of core...
Yes.
Economic.
Yes, because I'm, and the reason I'm saying that is because where are these billions going to come from? When are we going to repatriate them from? And from whom? Where do we even begin? How long is a piece of string? And I think that at a time when the state itself and most of us, you and me and other taxpayers, are not really in a position to bail out Eskom or SAA any further, we may have to think about that a bit more carefully. And I mean, there are a few other models that one might think of, but most of them should include the state as a very key focal point.
As a majority shareholder
always
still.
As a shareholder, yeah. Yes. Go ahead.
Now, there's also that Eskom, the argument around generation and transmission as well, as that would be some way to
mitigate,
to restructure Eskom without sort of completely
dismantling.
Maybe
it.
That goes towards your point of having sort of provincial power generation and some separate kind of then sales distribution.
And I think also to recalibrate Eskom into an energy supplier, not only an electricity supplier. And I'm surprised that this hasn't been, there hasn't been a much greater effort towards that, because we do have, within the NDB, that there's a 2030 energy supply plan. And then, of course, there was a plan that was released about 2 weeks ago as well, just before the MTEF, in fact, which also spoke to this idea of trying to have sort of an
industrial
energy.
Transforming the power grid.
And again,
sustainable energy.
Why we're not doing that is anybody's question. We have like 8 months of sunshine in the air. Look, I am not an environmentalist, but even I can see the sun shining and the wind blowing. And of course, these are not quick fixes, Nicholas. But certainly, within 2, 3, 4, 5 years. Quite a few of us could begin to be migrated from off the grid to something that is a multi-energy complex. And that's where we probably need to be going, rather than trying to, get nuclear deals from different sorts of quarters, which are going to be even more costly, going forward. So the budget then didn't really say much other than that that Eskom in particular is going to be bailed out yet again. And even though the minister spoke, he gave his best school principal voice to say that this time it's coming back, I think I just sat and thought it's never come back before, and nobody got detention. So I don't know why, what guarantees that we have that it's going to come back this time. And what's the business model to suggest that it can come back? And by when? Within the next 10, 15, 20 years? When is it actually coming back? So I think, that's kind of the link between the document that the minister released. And as you say, under circumstances which were slightly confusing, because the thing is, it's never really traditionally been the role of Treasury to release policy documents, right? It would be probably the Department of the DTI, or what used to be the Ministry of Economic, the one that EP used to head, Economic Development, the very quiet ministry, and I'm hoping that he will become a bit more explicit now that he's now the Minister of Trade and Industry. That would be really interesting, because I think that offers us the opportunity to have a slightly more linear plan of action.
You kind of reminded me, it's something I do harp on quite a bit, and maybe something that I feel the ANC certainly hasn't explained, perhaps even to itself, but certainly to the broader population, is sort of that the economic infrastructure that they inherited 25 years ago was, as you've alluded to, geared very much to a specific part of the group within the population. And so there was a massive challenge right there to now the power grid must be for everyone, not just for 5% or 10% of the population.
Correct.
And I mean, I'm not one to say, apartheid or colonialism or our history is the be-all and end-all of all the problems that we face in this country, but there certainly still seems to be a legacy of our history that
we're living with.
And, that is kind of where I just I don't know how we get out of that.
Mm.
We talk about economic transformation, and maybe we can talk about that now. You talk about 40% unemployment. You mentioned just before we spoke about particularly the position of Black African women as a completely kind of sidelined group in any talk about transformation. How do we kind of get? It seems like we're in a kind of whirlpool of never ending misery.
Yeah, it does, doesn't it? So, I mean, it's an interesting question, loaded question, isn't it? It's a big question. So, the industrial complex that we as Africans inherited from the former minority, the minority government, was one which was, of course, embedded in huge structural inequality. And it was really built up on a couple of complexes. The one was the agricultural complex, and then the other would have been your resource and mining complexes. Those were your major ones. So there's never really been a thing called monopoly capital, but there've always been forms of capital that were monopolized by key cartels. And I think that to me is an important important distinction.
So even within those sectors, there's not just one dominant, but there are three or four dominant or five dominant or whatever companies that are still kind of managing the thing to their own benefit.
Look, they're all white, so I mean, it's certainly true that most of the capital in this country is still owned by white people, by white companies, white owned, white families. But yes, it's in terms of monopoly, as in it's just the one, not really, you know, it will be multiple forms. Even, by the way, if you look at the agricultural complex, within the agricultural complex, you have your cattle barons, don't you? You have your wheat barons, you have your...
Apparently you have potato barons as well.
Through KZN and stuff like that, like that's all they do.
There's like basically one or two families who run the potato industry in this country. Yeah. I was shocked to hear that.
And then down the coast as well, you know, your fish barons and so on and so forth. So I mean, it's that alone is quite fascinating. Mm. Where then I think, other than the fact that I do think that certainly the former regime had no interest in a successful African government, and I don't think that it would have been different had it been ANC, had it been PAC, had it been AZAPO. I don't think that would have been different, actually. I don't think that they had any real interest in a successful African-led government, because of course they understood that structurally there has been a way of doing things. There had been a way of an architecture, which meant that it was inevitable that it would implode to some extent if it wasn't mitigated on time. So the places and the spaces where it should and could be mitigated or could have been mitigated, and I hope still can be, would be in trying to break up the cartels. That's the one thing, you know, break up a lot of those agricultural cartels, and certainly break up a lot of the mineral cartels as well. It is still shocking that you have a few families which essentially are feeding the nation, right? You know, a few sort of primarily Afghana families that are feeding the nation. And of course, that also means then there'd have to be a really long-term plan of skills transfer, a long-term plan to do something with the land question, a long-term plan to then also put in place an African-based skills layer of people who are agronomists, agriculturalists, seed technologists, biotechnologists, geologists, and so on. So it's a whole sort of a plan that you think about over the next 5, 10, 15 years of really ensuring that in order to do this, the land issue has to be resolved. There are no two ways about it, but it also has to be resolved in a way that once this land is restored into African hands, we are then in a situation where we are handling it, we are managing it, we are it's productive land, and so on and so forth. I think that would be quite important, because I wouldn't want a situation where the whole land question becomes discredited, because perhaps we could have done things differently, right? And then the other part of that is then, and for this I'm not sure I have the answers of how to break up the resource and the mineral cartels, because those are also quite pernicious, very aggressive, tied up with interests on Wall Street and in the United Kingdom, gold, mineral, and diamond, and because of the sway that they have, not only over local economies but global economics, right? So that's really globalized apartheid, basically, institutionalized economic apartheid. That is much harder to break up.
The land question, because I did watch one or two of your clips that you interviews you've done recently, and agriculture is a space that you obviously are quite sort of focused on, and tied into land. What is the sort of process for land redistribution? Would you say?
So the state has an important role to play in being an arbiter in that regard, and I think needs to be a bit more aggressive and a bit more decisive about it. Probably, I think one of the reasons why the land issue has been peripheralized and overly politicized over the past, well, I think from 1955, if we take their moments from the Cliptown Charter, and then you fast forward to 1994 to this dispensation as well, and in fact you can track it backwards to the moment when an ANC delegation, I think it was 1912, when they went to meet King.
Did they go to England?
England to meet, yes, King George, as well.
Petitioning
him. I think that was Queen Elizabeth's grandfather. That would have been.
Yeah.
Yeah, that would have been straight after Victoria.
Straight after Victoria.
So, I mean, there's sort of those key moments, and that was an interesting moment because I think that was a time, and that was at a moment when the ANC still had a clear articulation on land and on landlessness. I think that the respectability politics that they tend towards may have made it a bit more difficult for them to articulate it, I think, more vigorously. I think then when we get back to 1955, which I think is a moment of terrible, dire, complete capitulation of the African cause, of the African revolutionary cause, is in 1955.
Where the Freedom Charter?
The Freedom Cheetah, as many of my contemporaries would prefer to call it, which says that the land belongs to everyone. Mm. It cannot belong to anyone. It doesn't belong to everyone in England. It doesn't belong to everybody in Japan. It doesn't belong to everybody in the US. It doesn't belong to everybody in Mexico. It doesn't belong to everybody in Nigeria. Does not belong to everybody in France, but only in South Africa have we been forced to say that the land belongs to everybody. It does not, you know. It never has, and it never will, quite frankly. And I think that that kind of lack of positionality and positioning African interests at the center is something that the ANC has grappled with for whatever reasons. And then we just fast forward to the 1994 moment, right? The Constitution. And again, the Sunset Clause, 1913, which again gives away the few crumbs that the African majority had already left by 1913 and completely ignores the previous 300 years plus minus of land invasion, land capture, and so on, as though nothing had ever happened. It is theft. It is, you know, an invasion that we're still living with, right? And if anybody thinks that land is not important, if you go through any African township in this country, any African-based rural area, and the difference in living standards, life outcomes, you will see that land means everything. It is life and death, literally. The environmental impacts of having land, the spiritual attachment that we have to land, the capacity for sovereignty. And I think one of the greatest victories, in inverted commas, of the colonial apartheid machinery was to displace African people from their land and to begin to build the lie that it's not really important. And if it's not important, then when and how are the
How does it change?
And how and when are these primarily white agricultural cartels going to just give it back, since it's not really that important?
I want to touch a little bit on the other component you did mention, the sort of mineral mining component of our economy, and the fact that this government now seems to be still very much beholden to mining interests over the interests of the broader population, if I can put it that way. If you look at some of the even land struggles around mines in this country, the government. So again, it's a kind of you just wonder, like, what it's like a schizophrenic kind of behavior then from the ANC that I can't seem to get my head around. And I'm just wondering what their sort of end game.
I wouldn't know what their end game would be, but it's very interesting that you mentioned that these skirmishes around mineral resources and around mines, and especially a lot of the mining towns, and that interface again between land and mines. And in fact, when it comes down to it, it's actually one industrial complex. I mean, whether mines are land as well, and this whole feeds into this notion of manifest destiny, that it's the role of civilizing the savages, the kind of discourses that your Columbuses and your Mayflower, your Mayflower passengers took with them to the United States, right? And the same sort of manifest destiny.
Like we're here to help.
We're here to civilize, and we'll do so with as much uncivility and brutality as it takes. We'll make gentlemen and ladies out of you, damn it.
Even if we have
we'll have to beat it into you. That's right. Beat some decency, some decent English values into you. Exactly right. And that's sort of like been carried over. And then, of course, using really strange legal illegalities like terra nullius, right? The idea of empty land, which is like an old, very archaic legal instrument that was used to justify invasion across the continent, across the Americas, across the Antipodes as well. And it keeps on reproducing itself, because by emptying out the most profitable, the most arable, the most the best pieces of land, emptying them of African people, it continues to play into this notion of emptiness, right? Empty land, empty. Those are over there. So Group Areas Act, placing people in these industrial complexes where they are basically, as Africans, we were basically just a worker force. Portioning away siphoning away our land in rural areas, as you're well aware, siphoning us into these little semi-autonomous, quasi self-governing little Bantustans, basically, which were basically large-scale reservations, which would have been a technique which was very similar to what was used in the United States. The challenge that the colonial apartheid machinery has always had with South Africa is, for better or for worse, the numbers. They just, unlike Australia, New Zealand, Canada, the United States, and remember that South Africa was actually supposed to be like another part of that belt.
Yes,
that
belt of whiteness.
The belt of whiteness, exactly right. The manifestation of manifest destiny, and annihilation of the indigenous people. So that has always been the little tricky little sticking point in the South African situation. Many flies, millions of flies in the ointment of the white supremacist plan. Exactly. So even there, then you find this notion of being reproduced even now. And I find it really disheartening, depressing when we hear, the languaging that we use. When we're talking about township, we're talking about black people. When we're talking about township economies, we're essentially talking about African economies. When we speak about leafy suburbs, we're essentially talking about whiteness. I think the three black families on this street, for example. We're talking about, the leafy suburbs, and the way that in many regards these are maintained. So when I go jogging down here, I have to, I remember that I am being policed and that I am an infringement on a white person's imagination. How do I know this? The way the dogs keep bellowing at my presence. So even though we don't have the legislation has been struck down, cognitively, there is a sense of belonging and non-belonging, personhood and non-personhood. Every time those stupid dogs are barking at me, they are trying to remind me that I don't belong here. In a way that if it were you, for example, walking down the same street, you wouldn't get the same sort of... So there's so many different machineries that have been put in place. Another machinery that the apartheid colonial machinery or mechanism that the machinery put in place was the notion that African people must always be in a situation of servitude, right? And I'm always fascinated that, like, churches, and all of these other churches, they used to take collections every Sunday to ensure that every white family, no matter what their material circumstances, could afford to have a domestic worker. Quite a little known fact, yeah. And what was that about? That was about ensuring that no matter how... frankly, bottom of the barrel you were.
You were still feeling a little bit superior.
You should always feel superior. And again, that's been something that's been ingested. I mean, that is why even now, and of course, let's not forget job reservation where, and totally unskilled, frankly, sometimes semi-literate, quite out of the box, young person would be brought in to supervise, in a supervisory position. Exactly that. And this was also not coincidental. By the 1920s and 30s, there was a small, not massive, but there were the beginnings of like class solidarity and class alliances between African workers.
Talking about the 1920s, 30s?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. There were small, you know, the beginnings of small...
There was a bit of a gap there, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. And then the new urban class, you know, especially the people, you know... but primarily men, you know, who had been brought to work in the mines or who had come migrated from the countryside to come and work in mines. But the beginnings of a nascent, what could have been a very powerful class movement. Right? Of resistance. So of course the regime could not have, you know, white people running around the streets of this country saying, "Workers of the world unite. We will not be stopped. Pay us now," or whatever. One job, one salary, one nation, or whatever. They could not possibly have that. So you see, there've been all of these mechanisms to ensure that whiteness was privileged, and that there was a benefit to it. You know that, and even the notion of race as a social construct. I mean, there's a whole other stuff which is outside the remit of this interview, but even really interesting work that's been done about how how Italians in America became white. So they were not always considered white, but how they became white later on.
Absolutely.
And now we're having the same sort of conversations with the Eastern Europeans, and of course who have been entering the rest of Europe in quite large numbers, the UK, France, and so on, and how they're white. They're also now becoming white, and race as a social construct and as a construct of superiority, of control, and so on and so on. And I think South Africa has offered us a really interesting way to show the interface between race and the economy and privilege in ways that are very toxic but very tangible day to day.
I want to now I do want to touch a little bit on some of that research you spoke about, particularly with relation to South Africa and the subcontinent and the continent overall.
Yes,
but I do want to just talk a little bit about the state of women, black African women in particular, in our country, in our economy, and how they seem to have... You were saying sort of earlier that they seem to be completely sidelined, really, from any sort of discussion about policy and about the economy overall. Can you just maybe touch a little bit?
I will.
Does that make sense, what I'm
saying? Yeah, it does. I will. Firstly, I'm not black African. I'm an African. So I don't do the...
the qualifier, because I'm not going to be qualified in the country of my forebearers. But the second part of that is peripheralized, even in the way. So I think, yeah, it's important to note that most of the work that we do at Trade Collective must have a feminist perspective. So, you know, always a race feminist lens with the work that we do. So the whole the employment complex in this country is fraught with bunches of minefields and potholes, and these potholes are the one is structural inequality and the structure of this of our economy. It's very much capital intensive and very labor intensive. The second pothole that we have is a skills, I won't say underskilled, but skills misalignment. Although I say that with reservation, because it's not always true that having more skills will get you more employment. Hmm. The third part of that is also that we don't have multiple entry points into employment. So the assumption has been that, to use a very classical model of entering the job market and to entering market economics, which makes a few assumptions. It assumes that you have full to almost full employment, and that's only true across Europe, to a lesser extent in the United States. That isn't true in Asia, most Asian countries, except barring Japan and a couple of others. It isn't true across Latin America as well. So we have a completely different economic structure. The other sort of pothole that we have is, other than, of course, the ones that I've mentioned around access to land and access to resources, is also that we have a job market that isn't reflected in the way that we make policy. So we say, we hear ministers saying things that are funny, I think, I'm like, okay, come on now. Let's give young people tablets across schools, across, you know, African-based schools, right? And that's going to do what exactly? So, I mean, we're not getting the fundamentals right, such as getting our kids to read, write competently. Mm. And also we're not getting the fundamental rights, such as delivering hard copy books to schools, let alone tablets, right? So, I mean, other than now,
let alone toilets,
where we have children still drowning in pits, drowning in gak, really. And that's like a metaphor and a literal experience, right? And then, we also are not doing the basics, which is appreciating that our education system cannot be based on, you know, I think the last iteration that I saw was based on some New Zealand model. I mean, we like going to like obscure places.
Finland is always
the Scandinavian. But, and I mean, again, the context of Scandinavia versus South Africa is like,
it's far away,
poles apart, right? Yeah. And it suggests a particular education system. It also suggests that children have been remediated and have been examined to a particular level by a certain age. And if we then try to transpose that into a high school situation where children's competencies are different to those of the original context, it just doesn't work. So those are the basic things. So that's one of the many potholes. So what happens in the midst of all that? You then don't have an economy that's really interested. So this is this gap between policy, education, and then where women are. So we've got all of these phenomenal, the IPAP, industrial policy, is actually quite interesting, Nicholas. I mean, we should have been building cars, we should have been building our own cell phones, and like even in terms of the things that we need, there's this kind of like set of component parts.
Creating a manufacturing base kind of thing.
A manufacturing skills base, which would deal with this. It's becoming almost a rhetorical mantra of, we need to be much closer to the global value chain. The global value chain starts right here, because there's a departure point for the globe, right? No matter where the destination of any product or service is going to be, this is the departure point, not some unnamed space. It's right here
and now.
Yeah, it's right here, and it's in our education system. Statistic after statistics has illustrated that one of the best ways to grow your economy is to have a qualitative education system. Now, so not just throwing money at it, but qualitatively spending the time to get children reading and writing. And then the other part is, of course, having a healthy population, right? Mm-hmm. So having staff that works at state hospitals, having available regular checks, eye checks, ear checks, health checks in schools across the country, those sorts of things, which would really help to improve the quality of life. And those are not terribly complicated things. Mm. And remember that now that we've got like these hundreds of billions of rands that are at large, and we've been looking so outwardly at your state OEs, your SOEs, to go back to where we began, where then is this going to, how do we bridge these two? Because our problem is that we don't view education and health as part of the infrastructure. Infrastructure is always about midupi or
the freeway.
The freeway, the ethos, that's infrastructure. It has to be big and bad. And that's an incredibly masculinized way of viewing the world, right? Because it has to be big and loud and noisy, in order for it to be proper infrastructure. Very machinist way of viewing the world. And yet schools and hospitals surely must be one of the ways to...
Fundamental.
And I say this because when the shortfall happens, it is always women who then are not able, are not able to complete their schooling, but also when the shortfall happens, when the health system is not working optimally, or if the education system is not optimally working, it is women who have to deal with mopping up that exercise. And in a country where very few people are on the edge, are on the health grid, the healthcare grid, and that includes private medical healthcare, private health insurance. Very few people are on the formal grid, and we don't see that as a grid, right? We think about being on the grid as being, you've got Wi-Fi or you have electricity, but nobody thinks of being healthcare,
access to
healthcare as being on a grid. And very few people are on a qualitative healthcare grid, and that should be much more worrying to us than what's going to happen next with Eskom. I mean, it is worrying, but I mean that should be absolutely appalling to most of us. So to go then to the policymaking doesn't mirror any of this, because by the time we go to the policymaking, we have created languaging and vocabulary and the ideology of our policymaking, which suggests that we are peripherizing women, we are peripherizing the others, we are objectifying poverty, and we're actually poverty shaming. There's this kind of a very bootstraps mentality. If we look at most of our previous plans, the Asgisa, the NDP, the 2030 plan, and now the one that's been presented by Minister Mboweni, it's very bootstraps orientated, and it's also very industrialist. So one of the,
When you mean bootstraps, you mean like if you work hard, you will be okay kind of thing, or put your mind to it and kind of...
Bootstraps, yeah, kind of that classical liberal, the classical liberal objectification of people, exactly. Behaving as though being a service provider of homes, of water, of electricity, of healthcare, of education is a Christmas bonus. Yet it's actually, these are really, the languaging is, the languaging is very much around this is our intent, and we, the state, are going to do this for us, without any appreciation that it's actually we, the people, who pay taxes for this to happen. We vote for this to happen. This should happen. This is the bare minimum. This is just the bare minimum of what we should expect.
Of course.
Yeah. And I mean, hence we have these strange, these ridiculous press conferences, especially around election time, 1,000 taps. It's like, really now, 2,000 new houses have been given, you know, this ribbon cutting. Why are we cracking champagne about things that should be happening?
The natural part role of the state.
As a constitutional requirement. So many times our policies just don't marry the reality of many African women in this, most African women in this country. So they're drawn up backwards. We go for them. Most people go when they're asked to gender mainstream, which is a term and a process that troubles me deeply. They will say, "Well, we had 10 workshops. There were 100 people at these workshops. There were 50 women," and they'll pat themselves on the back and say that they were gender sensitive, and yet we don't know anything about the impact, the levels of participation, the ways in which these have shifted power and are leading to a transformative agenda in that particular area. It can be take any policy. You know, you can take, it could be anything. It could be urban planning. It could be public safety, right? And even there, look at the way that most of our cities are designed. Look at the way that the distance from public transportation, the relationship between public safe, affordable, accessible, 24-hour public transportation, public lighting, public policing, community policing, where you have a visible presence of people, where people can feel safe. And you know, heads up, South Africa, ADT, CMS are not police. Those are private security firms. And this is the problem, where the state outsources its own functions to the private sector in ways that in many respects are quite unacceptable. And then the link between that by the time you get home and you're off the energy grid, not able to study for as long or not able to kind of take on other forms of activity. So there's a whole link towards that. And that's even before we get to the structural biases in employment, which, you know, inherently disfavor women. You know, levels of pay, intrinsic abusiveness and, you know, harassment. By the time we're getting to the harassment and the manifestation of it, that's really a manifestation of a much deeper culture of, you know, misogyny, disrespect for women, and so on and so forth. So that carries over in the levels of work that we do, the kinds of salaries that women receive, but also when you look at the way that most of these policies, including the latest, frame women's work, it's always peripheralized. So it is usually clouded under something called the care economy or informal economy. And considering the high levels of unemployment of African women, about 65% at least in this country, 65% who are otherwise employed. Okay, so I think that the unemployment figures are important, but you'll find that we are otherwise occupied, right? So hustling, and I call that the hustle economy. Yeah, you heard it here first. Hustleomics, right? So it's including even the men at the traffic lights, you know, selling,
trying to do something,
hustling, you know, trying to sell you a phone charger that you don't really need, trying to sell you
some sunglasses
that are gonna fall apart a week later, but it's, you know, it's all good, but trying to do something, flowers, anything, you know. And it makes me sick to my stomach when people say that Black people are lazy. It's like, you've got to be joking. You have got to be joking. And then that's also linked to, you know, people, whether they're doing, women doing, you know, hairdressing, small-scale manufacturing jewelry, manufacturing clothing, also manufacturing pieces of furniture in different ways. But we don't valorize it accordingly. We'll just say those women, and then we will fetishize them and call them makumalo. I mean, leave makumala alone. And then we don't, because of the nature of that sort of work, it's not easy to aggregate the actual contribution to the GDP, but I can tell you now that even across the Southern African region, in a year, the last estimate that I had, which was a while ago, suggested that per year, that so-called formal and I call parallel economies contribute to about $17 billion. Yeah, to the GDP across the region. That's not insignificant. Right? That's not insignificant at all. So our policy hasn't caught up with any of that.
Is that reality?
No, not at all. Neither have the business support mechanisms, you know, our CEDAs, our IDCs, our NEFs, because again, it's back to what? The big stuff, the big noisy stuff, not the stuff that isn't as tangible and yet keeps it moving. It keeps it moving in different ways.
Yeah, sure. We need to start wrapping up, and I still have a couple of things I want to touch on. You've mentioned now the region. I've always had the feeling that South Africa really hasn't engaged with the continent on so many different levels. Mm. You know, I was always struck when you go to a city like London, for example, there's just groups of kids from all over. There's just languages
everywhere.
These kids are coming there for, even if it's a semester or a couple of weeks or something, to just engage with England, with London. And I just wondered, I mean, I just have that sort of fantasy of, you know, groups of South African kids going to Luanda.
Yeah.
For a school semester or Lagos or whatever the hell. I mean, and that's just that sort of school basic kids level. What about, I know South African companies have attempted sometimes successfully to move into Africa. But South Africa, the government somehow still seems to be a little
skittish,
distant somehow. What is that a kind of, again, a legacy of our past? Was that a sort of arrogance from the ANC or
both? I think it's a bit of both. I think, well, you know, distant and yet far, you know, distant and yet quite close. So we're skittish.
Well, Nairobi is 4 hours flight away. It's not,
but it's also a question of resources. How many people are going to afford that? You know what I'm saying? So I think we have to find different ways. We have to find different ways to come together and really have a real
Pan-African
agenda, right? So, but interesting that you say a bit aloof, a bit skittish, and I think skittish because there has been so the fear of being called big sister or big brother has caused quite a lot of inertia in just moving the program forward. So for everything that the African Renaissance meant or the, NEPAD and so on, it was a program, you know, or something really tangible. I think former President Mbeki was trying to occupy that place of leadership.
Trying to cultivate some sort of relationship.
And I think there was a lot more of an attempt, I think, to cohere. I mean, we could certainly have a separate debate around the very market and slightly neoliberal underpinnings of NEPAD and its quite strong departure away from something a bit more homegrown like the Lagos Plan of Action, for example. But nonetheless, it was there. There isn't really anything that holds us together like that. I mean, Agenda 2063 is a very pedestrian at best set of ideas. It doesn't even hold much, it doesn't hold up very strongly to close scrutiny as a guiding framing document.
Policy document.
Not at all. It's barely a policy document. I mean, I'd say it's a set of interesting ideas and some of them not necessarily original and some of them quite weak ideas. So we're skittish. That's the one thing. And yet, Nicholas, I think it's important for us to remind ourselves and for the listeners to be reminded that despite everything that we hear around us and a lot of the social upheavals in recent weeks and months as well, South Africa is the single largest contributor to the African Union. So making massive contributions to the continent in different ways and in ways that are not only corporatist.
Right.
It's not just about
very flagship-y or whatever.
It's not just about can find Steers in any any African city, and you can find Checkers almost everywhere. Also very important region building exercises.
Right.
And then by way of also peacekeeping as well. One of the largest contributors, contributors to peacekeeping. Mm. And we also are one of the biggest contributors to loans, by the way, soft loans and not and might I add, in some respects, larger than China.
Huh.
Yes, larger than China and without the conditionalities of
of what
having to dream in Mandarin in order to access any of these, but just basically, you know, soft, kind, quite gentle loans across the continent. And, yeah, and so, I mean, so, you know,
it's good that we put it in perspective.
It's interesting, you know, it's like distant and yet very hands-on, maybe too subtle, maybe too discreet, maybe because of the whole, don't want to be called xenophobic, don't want to be called big brother. And yet there's so many positive, many more positive contributions to the continent that South Africa is making. And including, you know, a lot of peacekeeping in the countries from where many of our brothers and sisters who've now find themselves here have originated from. So it's an interesting kind of...
That's quite a fascinating cusp dynamic,
of activity. And I think, perhaps the naming of it, the being explicit about it, the putting it out there could be a lot better. But and also, what does a Pan-African agenda look like? And I think that what's also missing is sort of a sense where we hold African states at accountable as a whole, right? So. You know, many times, you know, you find people saying, you know, it's terrible here, et cetera, et cetera. We really need to build strong states across the continent where any African, you know, where I can walk into Rwanda and be like, you know what, I could do this. I could, you know, I could settle here for a year or two or five, make a contribution and so on, or walk into Nigeria. I mean, I find Nigeria, especially Lagos, a very vibrant it's full on, right? It's a very vibrant, bustling, difficult.
I've had the pleasure of visiting Lagos once or twice.
It's tough.
It's intense.
Yeah. It's not for the faint, but you know, it's like wow. You know, and I get there, and I'm like, you can learn a lot. You know,
guys are doing it. Yeah.
Survival skills, and guys are doing it. Guys, I mean, they hustle to another level. So, I mean, I think every African country has obligation, and we have the obligation to hold each other accountable, to build nations, African nations, where we all feel we are welcomed, we can be productive. And we can be, we can be welcomed, productive, and where we can make a contribution. But that also has to be mutual, right? And I think that it has been a bit difficult the last while because there's such an asymmetry between. So, I mean, for example, there's an asymmetry between, say, a Somalia and a Kenya. I mean, a massive asymmetry, right? Asymmetry between a Zimbabwe and a South Africa. An asymmetry between a Liberia and a Nigeria. And we really need to like work harder to ensure that we hold leaders to accountable for those asymmetries, and that we have a much more longer term community approach to trying to build each other. I mean, if you look at the history of the European Union, that's a fascinating case study. These are not, and unlike most African countries, they don't even necessarily like each other. I mean, it's not, you know, people don't get excited when they
talk about the French and the German, or
French and French the English, and the British. Well, British and almost everybody, quite well, the English,
well,
everybody.
They're proving
right?
it now, yeah.
Yeah, they've proven it now. But where it's, you know, it's not about affection, it is about survival. It is slightly
it's a practical
cynical.
Sort of, yeah.
It's a utilitarian, pragmatic approach of you know, former colonial powers realizing that. That their position in the world is diminishing and that they are better together.
Strength through numbers.
Than apart. And it's been very, very dispassionate. It's like, look, we're not necessarily going to learn
bureaucratic, very
German
kind of
in
technical.
Schools now, in English schools. But, you know, it's like, you know what? Let's just hold on to each other. And that's been the approach. I have the privilege of going across the world in different capacities. I mean, I don't see... You know, an Italian and a Norwegian saying, "Oh, my fellow European," and embracing each other across a crowded room, or, you know, there's a German and there's I don't know, a Spanish speaking person, and they embrace each other. And yet, African people inherently. I mean, if I'm around the world, it's like, my fellow. You know, if you're from Kenya, you're Nigeria, from Mali, my fellow
immediate
African.
Immediate kind of solidarity.
There's this kinship, which is very rare. I don't even think Asians have it per se. It is very rare. And I think we should really celebrate that we have that as a very important currency and build on that.
Yeah. I think that's kind of my dream as well. something like that. I just want to touch a little bit now. We've spoken about sort of the regional economies, the continent itself, how South Africa fits. And South Africa is, as we alluded to earlier, through its sort of industrial and agricultural components, part of a global economy as well. And one component that I know you've written about and do have some thoughts about is the role of ratings agencies. And I just want to keep you in the room. I would just like to, because in fact it was, I think, just this last week weekend, on Friday, yeah, on just on the eve of the rugby final,
yes,
Moody's
nice
thought they could
nice
come and
downer, yeah,
try and burst our bubble.
I tell you.
which they didn't. but what is a rate? Maybe just sort of, if you could just talk a little bit about what is a rating agency and how they've come to sort of maneuver themselves
the
in a way,
yeah,
into such an important, yes, not necessarily existence, but I mean that they
the
can actually
centralize their role in determining a lot of financial and sometimes political governance, and that therein lies the bee in my bonnet. Yeah. Mm. So I mean the big three as we know them, I mean they've been around on
is
average.
Is it Moody's is the one?
Fitch. And Standard.
Yeah, right. Fitch, yeah.
Yeah.
Fitch and Moody's are the ones that always spring to mind. Yeah.
So yeah. I mean they came into being at different times, but the oldest among of the three would be almost 100 years old, others 1930s, 40s, during the great, you know, the first one of the great recessions, the first great global, you know, recession, which was, you know, in the 1930s. And these then began to be instruments that people used to measure whether or not any investment would be viable, right? On the railways.
So it was as long ago as that they were doing that, but mainly at a company level.
Well, look, these are
basically
then consultancies, right?
Yes.
And this is where people, one company would say, I want a stake in company A, wants a stake in company B. So we go to
and Moody's
staff
will give you an analysis and say,
give
what
an
is
analysis.
The, yeah, yeah.
Now, at some point in the 1960s and 70s, states started approaching these entities to say, look, we want to, well, two reasons. Firstly, we want to borrow money. And we want to know whether this is the right time to do so. What is your forecast? The second circumstance would be we want to do a massive infrastructural development. Say the U.S. wants to do some infrastructural work in, it would be, you know, say Panama or Ecuador. And can you measure for us the efficacy, the wisdom of this at this time? And that was those were the circumstances under which states then began to engage with these small companies, and they were very small companies. Around the 1970s, 1975 or 6, the financial, fiscal, wada, but it's a US-based board which has
regulatory authority
type, set up a special commission, I was chaired by somebody whose name just escapes me, but basically they set up and they said one of the problems was that there was too. This is 1970s. Hey, I mean, I don't know how old you and I were then. Barely born.
I was little.
Yeah, barely born. And basically, one of the recommendations and the concerns was the over consolidation of power in these three little companies. And remember that they were actually at the time, there were quite a few, so there haven't always been the three, but you know, like any industry, there will be attrition, right? So
yes,
like Kodak wasn't always the only camera coming up, right? There'll always be attrition, chicken licking and KFC.
Attrition
and, other,
and consolidation.
Yes, so they were the attrition. So these were, they had already become the main three. The smaller companies were complaining, saying, but you guys get all the gigs. This is actually a de facto monopoly. And already there were complaints about collusion between the three of them. And we noticed that they pretty much run in tandem, right? Moody's being the slightly more liberal oftentimes. But Fitch and Moody,
standard.
Pretty much the ones that seem to have
The dominant sort of narrative,
the,
or the...
They're the ones whose opinions seem to be the most proximate to each other. That
Fitch and Moody's.
Fitch and Moody.
Yeah.
That can't be. And yeah, Fitch, Moody, S&P now. That can't be a coincidence. So those concerns were already arising, and at the time, one of the reasons for that was that you had to have handled a massive amount of money at any given time to be then ratified as one of the official. And at the time, because of the monopoly,
it was by process of attrition, it
had become these three. And of course, it had become those three when the regulations, the requirements were zero and they just ascended. Now we fast forward into the 1980s, where then that form of structural adjustment in the World Bank structural adjustment, where then the World Bank and others would then again consult with these ratings agencies and say, look, we want to give Congo or Angola infrastructure. We want to build a big stadium. Is this a good idea? Yes or no? That kind of thing. So again, states and your supra governmental organizations also then began to privilege them. Still, though, it wasn't so much about them pronouncing. There were guns for hire. Mm. And I think I should add, they are still guns for hire. Then what also happened was that states would then engage with them to say, look, we want to go and borrow a massive amount of money against our bonds, for example. But we want to do it at a lower rate. In order to do so, we need you to advise that we are stable, that we are, our currency is strong enough, that our debt situation is modest, and then we'll be able to borrow for a much lower interest rate. They were often willing to oblige. So basically, ratings for pay. Hmm. Yeah, ratings for pay. As we know, they've made many, many mistakes, 2008 being one of the biggest, but they'd made mistakes before then. They made mistakes, OPEC, 1970s, right, around the fuel crisis, the right. petrol crisis. They made massive got mistakes even there. They got the dot-com bubble wrong as well in the late 90s into the early noughties.
2001, 2002.
Enron. They missed Enron completely. So this idea that
they have some wisdom.
Ratings agents are these wise men, mainly men, these wise men sitting on Mars, far away from politics, far away from the maddening crown, above influence, you know, almost like this papal
sages.
These papal, Buddhist monkish type people who are incorruptible. It's a load of nonsense, absolute nonsense. So what this really disturbs me is the extent to which we have now, and over the last 5 to 10 years in this country, begun to give them. Their coming is a huge event. Not to mention that there have been several concerns raised about the sorts of tools that they use to gather their data. I mean, some of it is as simple as looking at web pages and deciding that, well, we think that you look unstable. We think that there have been, you know, we see a few pictures of Marikana and it's like, well, you know, we can't have that. So really, you know, bordering, I mean, I won't name them, but I know there's one analyst, another sort of public intellectual colleague of mine who has made it clear that he's not going to be helping them anymore because he's given them a lot of data
that
they don't use it. I've put up my hand many times to say, look, if you need an in-depth, balanced opinion, or even if you don't think it's balanced, speak to
something
many people,
different.
But
yeah.
you know, at
yeah.
least have a 360 degrees exactly. of opinions yeah. and yeah. of thought. And they have never, and I'm saying it on the record, they have never taken me up on it. Yeah, never, ever. And then, so, you know, in the midst of all of this, you have now begun this situation where we have privileged them to the extent where they pronounce on things which are far beyond their remit, in my opinion. They pronounce on things like, if you're getting a new minister, that is not the business of a ratings agencies. I mean, it's not for a ratings agency to decide that based on whether they like a particular finance minister or even a particular head of state, that's going to implement, that's going to impact the way they rate a country's stability. That's going into the realm, not even into realm. That's absolutely bungee jumping into political debate. And that's extremely problematic. All the worse because these people are opaque. We don't know who they are. We don't know what criteria that they're using, even though that, you know, most of them have their criteria in the public domain. But there's no right to reply. That's the other thing. Once they've pronounced, we don't have the right to reply, the right to appeal. And we're not the only ones who feel this way. India has been saying that they no longer want to have Moody's the big three. So they want to set up their own. There have been rumors about BRICS, maybe a BRICS ratings. The UN, France have, you know, the EU in particular, have wanted their own kind of ratings agency because they have always felt, especially in the last 10, 20, 30 years, that it's very American. Yes, it's very America-centric. I mean, it's preposterous that it's only until a few years ago that the U.S. in all of its flummox and all of its glory had a triple A rating. Again, is it also a coincidence that nearly all the countries that have a triple A rating are in Europe? Can that be coincidental? I think exception in Asia being Singapore, not even China. And I mean, and they've got the fundamentals right, leave alone human rights. But I mean, hey, for every human rights abuse in China, there's a Guantanamo Bay for the U.S. So, you know, what criteria exactly are we using? So for all of those reasons, I really think that we give them way too much airtime. Mm-hmm. And we really need to focus on doing the fundamentals that are right for us in our context. And I think we have other ways of holding each other and holding our states, holding our economies to account. And they cannot be faceless, nameless American companies, all of which, by the way, also have strong links to the U.S. Federal Reserve. Mm-hmm.
Lebohang, thanks so much for your time today.
Thank you, Nicholas. Great fun. Thank you.
Cool discussion.
Thank you.
Yeah, let's hope we see that pan-Africanist future.
It's got to come. It's got to come. Maybe not in this lifetime, but it's got to come.
Thanks again.
Thank you.
Well, I hope you enjoyed that. It was pretty wide-ranging, you know, from state of the economy to sort of the historical legacies, I suppose, of colonialism and apartheid that I think are still very important for us to consider when we discuss our present. Sorry for some of the popping. There was some popping and bumping, and I noticed that during the discussion, so I'm sorry about that. I just sort of noticed that when I was doing the editing. Now, some nice to sort of get a different also idea of where South Africa sits in the subcontinent in relation to other countries in Africa, and some of the maybe not so public ways we are supporting other countries across the region. Interesting what you said about Eskom and perhaps, you know, hinting at the need for some sort of, not perhaps full privatization, but certainly selling off some components of the company, but maintaining a state majority ownership. And then the challenges within the mining and agricultural sector, and of course, land as a significant issue that does need to be resolved as quickly as possible. I must also mention that the editing software for this production is provided by Hindenburg Systems. You can find out more at hindenburg.com. Voices from SA is hosted on Audioboom. You may also subscribe to Voices from SA via Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Radio Public, Deezer, or indeed wherever you get your podcasts. Tell your colleagues, tell your friends, tell the world. Until next time, I'm Nicholas Klotjes.